Well, welcome to the studio, Tom. We're talking to Tom Stanton about his new book, Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. And it shocked this reader, too. I had no idea that Detroit's history was that corrupt and that dark. Tom, can you give us a synopsis of your new book?
Sure. Yeah, a lot of people are surprised to hear of the Black Legion. But back in its day, it was nationally known. People were familiar with it once it was exposed in May of 1936. But it was a secret society, kind of like the Ku Klux Klan, only even more violent. And they were killing.
And that's saying something.
Isn't it? Yeah, sadly. They were operating throughout the Midwest, particularly in Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana. And they flourished in factory towns like Detroit and Pontiac and Flint, but also in Jackson and other parts of the state of Michigan. And the numbers were estimated in the tens of thousands of members. Mm. Many of them inducted against their will, you know, tricked into going to a meeting they thought was a barbecue or a card game, and finding that they would at some point be surrounded by men, other white Protestant men in black robes and hoods and skull and crossbone outfits with guns pointed at them and taking an oath of office to go to their death, to hold the secrets or do the will of the Black Legion.
Well, if there's any room for sympathy in any of these people, when I read that, I thought, gee, what would I do? I mean, they threaten these people with either killing them or their families or, you know, what would you do if, but it's a terrible situation to be in.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there were people who, after they took the oath, would try to avoid the Black Legion, and eventually they might end up with a bunch of Black Legionnaires on their porch who want to get them back in. Coming to the meetings, or they'd be taken out to a field and tied to a tree and lashed. The Black Legion was described itself as for Americanism, which meant they were against every other ism, you know, Judaism, Catholicism, Negroism, progressivism, unionism, you name it. And consequently, they got used in the factories to as a way to keep unions out. They were co-opted by the those forces within industry. And their mission, though, it was scattershot. It depended on who was in charge locally. And it could be as petty as forcing you to get rid of your Catholic housekeeper, if you were a member, to killing a African man such as Silas Coleman for the pure pleasure of it.
That was a stunning episode. I mean, it's just like, I wonder what it feels like to kill someone.
Yeah.
That's all it took.
Right. And, you know, they had assassination plots, most of them failed, fortunately, against a newspaper publisher, a suburban mayor, a leftist attorney. They did successfully kill, in the estimation of Captain Ira Marmon and the Michigan State Police, more than 30 people in, I'm sorry, more than 50 people in southeastern Michigan. They were prosecuted and convicted on only two of those murders, so people got away with it. Once it was exposed, they ran for cover. You know, they burned their uniforms.
They scuttled
under rocks. And one of the reasons I believe, I point out in the book, that more people weren't prosecuted, as I believe there was a cover-up as a result of a lot of public officials having used the Black Legion for votes, not necessarily, in my mind, aware of all of the horrific things happening in their name, but nonetheless being willing to use it to the anger that was part of this movement for votes and to stay in office.
Yeah, and it involved politicians, police officers, you know, the people that you're supposed to trust.
Right. And that's what a legionnaire would be told, a reluctant legionnaire, if somebody decided they wanted to tell or they were threatening to do so. It's, we've got friends in high places, and you're going to be framed. And, you know, there was a lot of stuff that happened that indicated that that was the case. There were a couple of arrests in southeast Michigan where people were found with the robes and arms in their car. And those cases just kind of disappeared.
Hmm. Would this be a spoiler alert if I ask, so what brought them down? So much power.
Yeah, it It was, you know, often when these bodies were found, their victims looked as if they had taken their own lives. Other times, the dead bodies along the roadside would have union applications tucked under the bodies. And so police, being led by a reactionary police commissioner at that point, Heinrich Pickert, were unlikely to investigate very heavily. Similarly with the blacks who were murdered. And so what brought them down was when Charlie Poole, a WPA worker, was found murdered along a roadside in Dearborn, not far from the River Rouge Ford plant. And initially they thought he was a gangster, and so his fingerprints had been sent off to the FBI, and they came back, and it just kind of opened the investigation, and a gunman talked. One of the amazing things, because there is, as you know, sports that's part of this story, and that's really the upside, you know, the city
of
champions.
Yeah, there's the flip side. There's the dark side, and then if you're a Detroit Tigers fan, yay.
Yeah, because there's a seventh-month period where the Tigers, Lions, and Red Wings all win championships, and Joe Louis is the undefeated, uncrowned champion of boxing. So in the one sense, you have this glorious moment. And on top of it, the Black Legion members in Detroit are sports fans, too. They're actually planning some of their crimes so that they don't interfere with the Tigers' schedule or luring somebody to their death using baseball as the way to do it. And that's amazing if you know Detroit Tigers' history, because the two biggest stars on that 1934-35 team were a Jewish first baseman, Hank Greenberg, and a very devout Catholic man, Charlie Gehringer. And so to imagine these guys rooting for the Tigers in one sense and then going out and trying to target Catholics, Jews, and blacks in the next was just baffles the imagination.
Yeah. Now, Tom, you're actually known more as a baseball writer, aren't you? How did you get interested in this story? And, of course, baseball is in here, too.
Yeah. Well, it stems from my childhood. I had an uncle who a lot of uncles who reminisce during the holidays in her basement about the era of the City of Champions. But one of them, an elderly uncle, would tell me this story about having been with his brother and two other artsy leftist friends in the Black Entertainment District of Detroit, Paradise Valley, one evening when a car pulled up beside them with two white guys in it who started questioning why they were there, what they were doing there. And my uncle, in retelling the story, said, "I thought they were Black Legion members," because the Legion had just been exposed. And they got the men pulled weapons on them and ordered them in the back seat. And my uncle thought he was going to be driven off to his death. It turns out, in this case, they were actually cops. And my uncle spent the night in jail, which was better than the alternative. Obviously.
Yes.
But that was the first time I'd heard of it. And over the years, I'd come upon other references and just decided, this was such a phenomenal story and such a major moment for it to have basically disappeared. Most people just are totally unaware of it.
Yeah.
But at the, you know, I went through 900 plus pages of FBI documents, Michigan State Police reports, every article you can imagine related to this.
I was going to ask you about the research. How difficult was it, since it seems so unknown?
Yeah.
How difficult was it to unearth some of these materials? Were you able to find other people to interview, to talk to in person with memories? Or
you know, not really, because, I mean, it was too long ago. So pretty much everybody who would have been involved would either be dead or 100 or older.
Yeah.
And so you're dealing with family members, and I certainly did interview, you know, children, grandchildren, actually just grandchildren, now that I think about it. But, and so we're far removed from it. And most people don't want, actually, if they even know about it, I don't think they want their family associated with
That's
it. For
true.
Example, they were led by a guy out of Lima, Ohio, Bert Effinger. And so I sent letters, emails, Facebook friends requests to every Effinger I could find in the Midwest. Not one response. And I know, you just know that's part of the family tree somewhere, because it's not not a typical name. But so I was living in the history books and archives and among microfiche and microfilm.
You know, another thing that struck me as I was reading this book, and like so many, I guess, thinking, gee, why haven't I heard about this? I thought back to those early school years when you get those textbooks and you read about how we're such good guys. You know, we're cowboys in white suits and white hats. And we don't hear about this in history when we're children and young students. And now when you read this, I mean, there's such a discrepancy between the two. I wonder if that struck you at all, that we get this whitewashed history, and then people like you give us the real story, the gritty stuff.
It's an interesting take. I hadn't thought of it in that perspective.
Is it just hard for us to look in the mirror truthfully?
Yeah, or? We tend to ignore the things about ourselves we don't like, I guess. And to me, one of the interesting questions is why some bits of history get elevated and we remember and are kind of noted through the decades, and others just disappear, because this was massive at the time. People were incredibly frightened because they're finding out that their neighbor, their father, their husband is a member of this group. And so it creates a paranoia. Who else belongs? Who do I don't know? Is my boss in this? Is my cousin?
Mm-hmm.
And that's reflected in the letters that were coming to J. Edgar Hoover, who was reluctant to investigate for other reasons, I suspect. But at the time, you know, there's a couple movies that come out, almost like made-for-TV movies, if there had been TV in there. There's one starring Humphrey Bogart. It's called The Black Legion. And so it's a big deal. I mean, there are radio serials, there are novels based on it, plays. The police detective magazines, you know, a dozen of those at that time, and they're all covering this. It's the cover story.
Yeah.
And so why did the Black Legion, why do people not know about it? They're much more likely to know about the Purple Gang in Detroit, you know, the Jewish rum-running gang, maybe because of the Elvis song.
So we've been talking a lot about the dark side. Give us for the sports fans out there who love to read about all the sports success that comes out of that city, Detroit, a glimpse of what happens in that same time period with sports. And it's mostly Tigers, but other teams too.
I focused on the Tigers and on Joe Louis because they were the two national stories. And the Tigers, it's just a fascinating collection of guys. I mentioned Hank Greenberg, who's this young Jewish slugger and becoming a national icon among Jews, and Charlie Gehringer. But two of the characters that I really enjoyed, one was a very intense manager, Mickey Cochran, who was kind of the spark plug to the team, but also a very dark, moody character who undoubtedly today would be on, and I don't mean this flippantly, mood-altering drugs. He had extreme highs, extreme lows, and actually just months after the World Series will have a nervous breakdown where he is flowing out to Wyoming mid-season to recover for weeks on end because the stress was so great. But one of the great fun stories that runs through this is relates to a guy named Schoolboy Rowe, a pitcher, and the love story that involves his future wife, Edna. He's on the Rudy Valley Show after he's won 14, 15 straight games, nearing an American League record, and he says a line on that show. It's the second highest rated show at the time. He says, "How am I doing, Ma? How am I doing, Edna?" And that "How am I doing, Edna" for his sweetheart follows him for the rest of his career. Amazingly, whenever he walks on a field, people are yelling to him something about Edna, and it's just kind of this sweet relief because you don't. You know, when you're writing a book like this, and when you're reading a book like this, you don't want to live just in pure darkness.
And probably for you as well, when you're writing this, and you know, a writer tends to get immersed in your work, and you probably needed a break too.
Absolutely. You needed a little bit of a light, a little bright in there.
Yeah.
And so the sports team certainly provide it to some degree. I don't want to give away too much of the story because there is a dark side to the sport team as well.
So you're on something of a book tour now, or are you going to be coming to Kalamazoo again?
Yeah, I'm going to be at Kazoo Books. It's been a few years since I've been there. This is my seventh book, and so I'm looking forward to seeing all the folks there, and hopefully some of your local listeners will come out and talk baseball and meet up.
Yeah, so we can get both the history buffs and the sports buffs, both.
I would love that.
Well, thank you for coming in, Tom. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed it.